This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On this holiday set aside to honor Christopher Columbus, we're going to focus on the achievements of another great navigator, the man who accomplished what Columbus actually intended to do. Indeed, the voyage of Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan is described as the most important in the age of discovery by author and biographer Lawrence Burgreen. His latest book is called Over the Edge of the World, Magellan's Terrifying Circumnavigation of the Globe. And he joins us now from our bureau in New York. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And not to diminish Columbus on Columbus Day, but why do you think Magellan's journey was the more significant?
Well, I think you could compare it to, if you were to make a rough comparison, to astronaut flights, Alan Shepard going up for 15 minutes, and then John Glenn circling the globe, with Columbus being Alan Shepard and Magellan being more like John Glenn. Magellan's voyage was about 14 times longer than Columbus's. Columbus was out of sight of land for a couple of weeks, the longest leg of Magellan's voyage, and halfway across the Pacific, kept him out of sight of land for 98 days amid tremendous suffering and deaths among the crew from scurvy. It was really an epic voyage, and of course included the navigation of the Strait of Magellan and discovery of the Strait of Magellan near the Antarctic Circle, which many naval historians consider the single greatest achievement of the age of exploration.
Well, we want to hear from you, the listener. What do you know about Magellan? What did you learn about him in school? How do you think Magellan's voyage changed the way we think about the world? If you have questions about the man or about his voyage or about how we think about the world as a result of his legacy, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And Lawrence Burgreen, if all of what you say is true, why don't we have a Magellan Day?
Well, that's a very good question. He is actually a man without a country because he was Portuguese who defected to Portuguese chief rival, Spain. Again, to make an analogy to current day or recent politics, this would be like a nuclear physicist defecting from the Soviet Union in the 50s or 60s to the United States. Well, the Portuguese have had tremendous disdain for Magellan because of his disloyalty, and the Spanish never trusted him, even though he sailed for Spain with the backing of King Charles, King Carlos. He was sailing with a crew that was often opposed to him. The Spaniards or Castilians aboard staged a number of mutinies. So he had difficulty winning respect. And this meant that he really lacked a clear place in history until the 19th century, when some English language historians began to champion a rather romantic view of Magellan and gave us the view that we have today, that we know Magellan, the first man to circle the globe. Of course, he was killed in the middle of the circumnavigation.
Indeed, he was killed in the Philippines, and we'll get to that as part of the story. But one of the things that you write about is that, yes, the Portuguese regarded him as a traitor. The Spanish, because of the way the investigation of these mutinies turned out, regarded him with some great suspicion, even after one of his ships finally made it all the way around the world. And it was the Elizabethan English who really began to champion his cause.
Mm-hmm. They wanted to take a leaf from Magellan's book. Magellan was widely admired in England, which, as you know, successfully challenged and defeated the Spanish Armada a bit later in 1588. And translations of Magellan's exploits, as recorded by his official diarist, Antonio Pigafetta, were very popular in England, of all places, which saw itself as a possible successor to Spain for control of the seas. That really means control of the world's economy.
And why was it that control of the world's economy at the time, a much smaller proposition
right.
than it is today?
Absolutely.
But nevertheless, we, in that clip that you may have heard at the beginning of the program, you compare spices at the time to the oil of today. Mm-hmm. Why were spices so valuable?
They were more than just food flavorings. They were used for medicinal purposes, for aphrodisiacs, to preserve the dead, So they could be, they were used for a number of things, and they were the most precious commodity around, and they were symbolic with luxury. In the Bible, you have references to myrrh and frankincense, and ever since biblical times in Western culture, spices meant luxury the way we associate diamonds and gold with something very, very valuable today.
And at the for all of those centuries, spices were brought overland on the famous Silk Road. That was disrupted at about this time when the Turks took Constantinople, and that kind of changed everything.
The disruption of the traditional trade route for spices meant that European countries were looking for new avenues, and they took this as an opportunity to try and make an end run around the traditional merchants who did this, most of whom were Arabs, and most of whom made unbelievable fortunes in trading and raising the price of the spices. So their idea was to sail across the ocean to go wherever the spices were from, and Magellan's idea was to sail to the Moluccas, the Spice Islands, and in other words, go right to the source rather than relying on these slow and now disrupted overland routes.
And the prices of these things were fabulous. It's hard to compare monetary values of the time and today, mm-hmm. but you write, for a seaman to be able to bring a bag of, I think, 17 pounds of cinnamon back to Europe would have been able to buy a whole ship, which was the greatest technological marvel of the age.
That's right. A seaman who could bring this back either legitimately or smuggle it back was pretty much guaranteed of having a safe retirement. And, of course, if you were a captain like Magellan, not only would you make a fortune, you could have lands that you could rule, that you could pass on to your heirs, and you could have titles heaped on you, and you would really win a place in history. So the stakes in this game were very large.
Indeed, recognized so by what turned out to be Magellan's great foe, a bishop named Fonseca.
Yes. Fonseca was around so long. He was an archbishop who managed the expeditions on behalf of the church and the crown. And he was the manager whom the explorers all loved to hate, because he was a very manipulative and devious person, a cold-blooded bureaucrat. Columbus despised him. He had many altercations with Columbus. And when it was Magellan's turn a generation later, there was Fonseca still in place and still thinking of ways to undermine Magellan's authority. He did that by whittling down Magellan's authority and by placing a number of Spanish captains under him, including Juan de Cartagena, who was believed to be Fonseca's illegitimate son. It was not uncommon for the clergy in those days to find advantageously place their offspring.
And a couple of other captains were loyal to Fonseca. And as you mentioned, mutiny was pretty constant, at least for the first part of the voyage, anyway.
It was the first thing that Magellan had to deal with because his Spanish captains felt that the course he was following was so risky that it would get them all killed. And they assumed that, well, he's Portuguese, so he must be doing this to further the Portuguese agenda by driving the entire expedition, which was 5 ships and 260 men, to destruction. And at first they simply dissed him. They wouldn't salute him in the way that he thought was appropriate. But then the mutinies, one after the other, became more and more violent and resulted several months later in a very violent mutiny where the mutineers actually captured 3 out of the 5 ships in the fleet, and Magellan, showing a masterful tactical ability to handle this crisis, won them all back within a day's time, but not at the cost of life and some considerable brutality.
And considerable brutality. Obviously, Magellan,
yes,
as you point out, a pretty nifty tactician when he needed to be, a pretty courageous man, and unquestionably a great navigator, a great leader, but truly brutal man at times.
Yes, a great man, but probably not a great dinner guest. And he was brutal because, in a way, that was the custom of the times. He was authorized to regard mutineers take on their mutiny with lethal force, and that's what he did. He tortured several of the mutineers. He executed several of them. He put their heads on pikes as warnings to other members of the crew that this would happen to them if they mutinied. And that was not out of the ordinary. He was within his rights to do that. However, that worked against him because one of the ships, filled with Spaniards, actually mutinied again after that mutiny and sailed all the way back to Spain and spread horror stories about this madman run amok, Ferdinand Magellan, who was torturing and murdering Spanish officers.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Shiro, who's with us from Akron, Ohio.
Yes, Neil.
Yes, hi.
Hi. Actually, I'm traveling from Chicago back to Ohio, but listen to your show all the time. I love it.
Well, thanks very much.
I am actually from Guam, and I was wondering if the author had any insight on some of... He talked about the atrocities that he committed against his, his fellow shipmates.
Mm-hmm.
But does the author, and I forgot his name, and I'm very sorry.
His name is Lawrence Burgreen, but that's okay.
Yes, Lawrence. Nice to meet you. I would love to read your book, but I was wondering if you talked about in your book anything about some of the atrocities that he committed against, like, the people of Guam. I'm Guamanian, mm-hmm. and... while a lot of people say that he discovered Guam and stuff like that, I think a lot of Guamanians are happy that he met his death in the Philippines because of some of the atrocities, some of the harshness that he committed against some of the indigenous people of the islands that he bounced around.
Well, Lawrence Burgreen, you do point out there are no contemporary accounts of the peoples on mm-hmm. whom this voyage had an impact, but mm-hmm. you do write a lot about what Magellan did, both good and bad.
These comments are fascinating because we only know about Magellan's voyage from European sources, from official sources and diarists and eyewitnesses and early historians, and we don't have texts from the various indigenous people that he visited around the world, especially in the South Pacific. And this comment that your listener made is so interesting because even today, every year on the anniversary of Magellan's death in April, the Filipinos stage a large outdoor pageant on the island of Mactan, reenacting the death of Magellan, because he was hacked to bits by a Filipino army. And his death is cheered by the throng. So clearly in the Philippines, even though the Philippines quickly became an early and very important outpost of Christianity in the Pacific, Filipino sentiment is against Magellan, who's seen as an invader. However, I should point out that no matter where he went in the Pacific, he received a different receptions in different places. Guam was a critical stopover in his voyage because it was his first landfall after 98 days of crossing the Pacific, and he didn't know where he was going at that point. He had no maps. He had no idea how big the Pacific was. He thought he would have been to China and back by then. And there he was, still only in the middle of the Pacific. Other islands that he went to, he received a very enthusiastic welcome. And sometimes he played the indigenous people skillfully, and sometimes he blew it. He terrified them with his guns. His men became violent or exploited their women. He changed his approach as time went on. He became more interested in religious conversion, even though that was not part of his royal charter, as his journey continued. Actually, that was what led more or less directly to his death, was the issue of religious conversion. So the relations between Magellan and the people he encountered about around the world are really fascinating, and we don't know enough because we can glean hints from what the Europeans say of their account, those eyewitnesses. But, you know, I wish we had those texts from the other side.
Yes. Thank you very much, Lawrence. And, Neil, you. I love your show. You're doing a great job.
Well, thanks very much, and we appreciate the phone call.
All righty. Thank you.
Bye-bye now. We're talking with Lawrence Burgreen about the explorer Magellan and what Burgreen calls the most important voyage in the age of discovery. The name of his book is Over the Edge of the World, Magellan's Terrifying Circumnavigation of the Globe. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after a short break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're discussing the explorer Ferdinand Magellan and one of the greatest voyages of all time. Our guest is Lawrence Burgreen, the author of Over the Edge of the World, Magellan's Terrifying Circumnavigation of the Globe. If you have any questions about the man or his voyage, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And Lawrence Burgreen, I have to ask you, I mean, you've written earlier books about Louis Armstrong, James Agee, Irving Berlin. Your last book was about a voyage to Mars. Magellan? Where did you get the Magellan?
Well, actually, that thematically came out of the Mars book, because many of the NASA scientists talked about Magellan as a precedent for their plan for exploring the solar system. Also, in general, when I write about people, I like to write about people who broke the limits of what people of their era thought was possible to do. Louis Armstrong did that in his realm of music, and Magellan did that in his realm of navigation.
There's so little written about Magellan. Oh, let me just follow that up for a second. You describe Magellan as really sort of straddling the era of the Age of Faith and the Age of Reason. Mm-hmm. Describe how that is.
Well, when Magellan undertook his journey, there were several different competing models of what the world was really like, and nobody really knew. There was the Age of Faith model, which placed a literal Jerusalem at the top of the globe, which said that there were only three continents, that said that you could literally sail off the edge of the world. You would disappear into fogs or vapors. There were all sorts of sailors' tales, which were very, very tightly held beliefs, that the ocean boiled at the equator. It took a long time to disprove that one. That there was a magnetic island, that if ships sailed past it, they would pull the nails from the ships and the ships would sink. Of course, there were all sorts of rumors of sea monsters wherever you went. Sea monsters and mermaids were articles of faith of sailors. But even the more sophisticated academic students of the globe labored under their own limitations. The Renaissance, of course, was a time of great rediscovery of classical learning, especially Ptolemy, the famous Greek-Egyptian mathematician. And although Ptolemy was a very, very sophisticated thinker and mathematician, his conception of the world was limited. For example, he didn't have a Pacific Ocean. He knew it was a globe, which was a big step in the right direction, but it was only two-thirds approximately of the size that it actually is. In fact, I think it's only a slight exaggeration to say that if Magellan and other explorers like him had known how big the world really was, they probably never would have set out on their journeys.
Here's an email we got from Scott in Phoenix, Arizona. I disagree that Magellan's voyage is the more significant. Yes, he covered more ground and charted more area, but Columbus set off across the ocean facing much more of the unknown. Magellan knew he would not fall off the edge or be attacked by great ocean-going monsters. He also knew that there was, in fact, land out there to find, all facts Columbus could not know for sure.
I really don't agree with that. I wish I could. Yes, Columbus was earlier, and he was a boyhood hero of Magellan's and directly inspired him. Magellan read about the early accounts, including those written by Columbus, of Columbus's journey. But the scale of the Magellan's expedition was so much larger, and the unknowns were greater, because nobody really knew what was going on the other half of the globe, and or really how to get there. He had a hard time, for example, finding a crew willing to go along with him, and he only accomplished that goal by in the first place not telling them where he was going, and then resorting to bringing peoples of about 10 different countries aboard his ship, which was difficult because they had difficulty getting along and even difficulty communicating with each other.
You write, you say that he didn't tell the sailors where he was going. The name of the armada was the Armada of the Moluccas. They knew they were going to the Spice Islands.
I don't think they realized what the name was until they were well underway. Also, you know, one of the questions I asked myself was, why would any sailor of that era go on this voyage or any other, because the risk of returning was so high. Because Magellan's expedition, almost everybody died. 4 out of the 5 ships were lost, and only 18 of the original men made it back 3 years later. So why would anybody go? And it was partly the lure, it was partly greed, the lure of great riches, and it was partly because they were desperate men. They were fleeing jail for one crime or another, or they were misfits. Some of them might have been conversos, in other words, secret Jews who had been expelled from Spain during the Inquisition. We don't know because they all changed their names. So they went for a variety of motives, and not all of them were entirely above board.
Let's talk with David, who's with us from Jamestown, New York.
Hello, Neil. Hello, Lawrence.
Hello.
Hello. I have a question concerning your admission of the 18 people that had completed the voyage. Mm-hmm. To my recollection, and I'm citing, I believe, Daniel Boorstin in his 80s bestseller, The Discoverers, and I think he made brief mention, if I can recall correctly, of his valet, a Moluccan slave, being credited to the only person that started the voyage from its beginning port to complete the voyage to its final destination. And I'm calling to find out what information or what input you have in this regard.
Enrique, who was Magellan's personal slave, is one of the really fascinating footnotes to the voyage, and I'm glad your caller brought that up. Enrique actually did the fleet great harm. Shortly after Magellan was killed, he betrayed the fleet to another chieftain in the Philippines who lured a number of the officers aboard and murdered, I can't remember the number now, it was about 20 of them, mm-hmm. At a banquet. This was just after Enrique considered himself to be liberated because Magellan was killed and a couple of Magellan's officers verbally abused him, and Enrique wasn't happy about that. After that, we don't really know what happened to Enrique. He's lost to history. He did not continue aboard the fleet, obviously, with the survivors on the way back to Spain. You could say if he really first came from that part of the world, he might have been the first person to complete a circumnavigation, but we don't really know exactly where he came from. And it seemed to me, and there could be different opinions about this, including Daniel Boorstin, who's obviously a very, very distinguished historian, that it was Magellan's expedition all along, and Enrique came with him because Magellan brought him.
Thank you, Lawrence.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
There's another fascinating character, less important to the story, though, a man named Juan Rodriguez. You said only one ship made it back, and that's true. Another ship, the Trinidad, tried to make it to Spanish Mexico, and it failed for various reasons. And
yes.
Captured by the Portuguese, who were very vindictive of that crew. Yes. Only four ever made it back to Spain. A deaf seaman, you write, named Juan Rodriguez, at the age of 48, the oldest survivor, stowed away on a Portuguese ship bound for Lisbon, spent a short time in jail, won his release, made his way back to Seville despite his age, his infirmity, and the hardships he had endured during his years at sea, applied to sail to the Indies again.
That's the thing about these sea stories. You know, they generate so many other stories. You can never get enough of it. You know, it's just incredible. There was another sailor, Ginés de Mafra, who was also a hardened old salt, who came back to, finally did make it back, was captured by the Portuguese, and years later managed to make it back, and found that his wife had remarried. She had spent all his money with her new husband, and he just gave up in disgust and shipped out again on the next ship bound for the Pacific.
Here's an email question from Sam Hulsey in Wichita, Kansas. Ask your guest, how was it possible to find Guam? It seems like hitting a gnat with a slingshot in the dark.
He did that. That's what he did. He didn't know where he was going. Cartographers have puzzled over other islands that seem to be close to Magellan's track that he didn't actually land on. And the question is, why did he avoid them? He wasn't actually avoiding them because he didn't know they were there. He didn't see them, and there wasn't any way to tell. But he actually was able to see Guam, and that's why he was there. But it was just coincidence. He might have kept on going for another few weeks.
People do forget how big the ocean is.
Yeah.
And how small those ships were. And you also write that he did not know, he could have learned from the people in Guam and other places, how they had learned to navigate among these islands by reading the ocean swells and the cloud formations and watching the birds.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. That was one of the few times that I was able to find something that gives us some insight about how Pacific Islanders managed to live their lives and deal with these ordinary everyday problems that Magellan was confronted with, such as how do you go around from island to island? And as I discovered, they learned how to read patterns of waves. They learned to look at the color of the underside of clouds. If it was green, it suggested they were reflecting the color of land. Obviously, birds, we all know about birds being an indicator of land being somewhere nearby. Magellan didn't know how to do this. He wasn't used to sailing across the Pacific, and he was learning as he was going. I mean, in that category of not being that well prepared for the voyage, many of his men didn't know how to swim when the voyage began. Imagine that. Circumnavigators not knowing how to swim. Many of them didn't know how to fish, although they learned. and the ships carried a lot of fishing gear along with them.
Let's get another caller. Micah is on the line with us from San Francisco.
Yes, I wonder if your guest is aware of a book called 1421 by Gavin Menzies, which attributes a lot of the inspiration for European age of exploration to earlier Chinese voyages, which included the drawing of maps, which made it to Europe in the period just before the age of exploration began.
And these would be the voyages of the Great Treasure Fleet.
Yes, that's
right. The Great Treasure Fleet, of which was actually only one of the fleets. What Menzies claims is that the Chinese actually sent out a number of fleets, specifically with the charge of actually circumnavigating the globe and charting it, so that they could bring it under the Chinese system of tribute.
Lawrence Berggren, you in fact have a long essay on this, but go ahead.
1421 is a really fascinating book and has touched off a whole debate about what the Chinese treasure fleet might have accomplished in its day. Keep in mind, it was 100 years before Magellan, by the time Magellan sailed into those waters that the treasure fleet probably explored, they were long gone, and the Chinese age of exploration had more or less wrapped up by then. Magellan, along the way, was baffled by evidence of Chinese civilization and Chinese commerce that he saw, and he didn't know what he was looking at. He saw porcelain, and he saw silk, and he saw examples of Chinese writing. He occasionally saw some Chinese merchants. Neither he nor his men didn't know why they were closing in on the Spice Islands then. And we know now that what he was seeing were the remnants of the once great treasure fleet. Now, when I say great, it was many times bigger than Magellan's fleet. In fact, it dwarfed it. Magellan's fleet was tiny in comparison to the great Chinese treasure fleet.
Mike, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Another email question. What kinds of ships did Magellan use? How big? Crew size? This one from Bill LaBarge in Holland, Michigan.
Good question. We don't know enough. They were small ships. They were about 90 or 100 feet in length. We don't have any illustrations of the actual ships that Magellan took. Four of them didn't make it back, so they weren't preserved. The one that did make it back, Victoria, which was among the smaller ships, was an old beat-up wreck by the time it made it back. Its owners fixed it up and sent it out again back and forth across the Atlantic until it finally sank in a storm some years later. So they were not preserved the way, say, we would preserve a space capsule today of some historic significance. We do know that they were capable of sailing fairly close to the wind, that they had lateen sails, which made them highly maneuverable. And we do know that they were primitive, so primitive, for example, that the men aboard those ships didn't even have hammocks. When they wanted to sleep at night, they just slept on a straw pallet. So they were very primitive vessels indeed.
Our guest is Lawrence Berggren. His book is Over the Edge of the World, Magellan's Terrifying Circumnavigation of the Globe. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted to ask you about the aftermath of this voyage. How did our view of the world, to begin with, change as a result of Magellan's voyage?
Well, I think for scholars and cosmographers of that day, we finally had proof. They finally had proof that it really was one world, because there had been some doubt about really what was the nature of the world that we lived in. Keep in mind that they still thought that our world was the center of the solar system, if not the universe, and that the sun revolved around us. They also realized that a number of myths that had been long held myths were disproved. For example, mermaids, various sea monsters, boiling seas at the equator. The fleet crisscrossed the equator four times and pretty much disproved that one fairly effectively. But the main question they were asking was a commercial question. And that was, can they get to the Spice Islands over water and make that a commercially viable route? And the answer was maybe. After Magellan's voyage, which, by the way, was considered a success because the survivors did bring back enough cloves to make a profit, King Charles sent a number of other missions. In fact, he just about bankrupted the Spanish crown doing it, but none of those subsequent missions succeeded. And in the end, King Charles and the Spanish crown became so desperate for money that he wound up giving up all claim to the Spice Islands to his main rival, the Portuguese.
And the other thing you write about, though, is that this was evidence of a new way of thinking in the world.
Yes.
That Magellan's trip really, you know, it didn't look back on old revelations or old ancient beliefs. He went out to look for himself.
I think, Neil, the concept that you were mentioning is autopsis, to go and see for oneself, from which our modern word autopsy derives. Magellan was really our first objective explorer and didn't rely on even rigorous mathematical projections of what the globe might be like. He went to explore for himself. When he was looking for the strait, he couldn't rely on a theory. He had to find it, and then he had to go through it himself to try and navigate that incredible maze of tidal estuaries himself. So it was a different approach to exploration.
Let's get one final call in, and Peter joins us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, Magellan, I think, should be also known as the man who entered the Pacific both from the Strait of Malacca as well as Magellan Strait, essentially opened up both gates to the Pacific.
Came into it from both sides.
Good point.
Thanks very much, Peter. Good suggestion.
You're welcome.
And yet, all of this, and the only thing named after him is that strait for which he is remembered, the Strait of Magellan. To not many people visit that. And, of course, one other thing, in the heavens, the Magellanic Clouds.
That's correct.
Those are the galaxies that his men first saw. They didn't know they were galaxies, I guess, at the time, but smudges in the sky, which have been named for the great explorer aboard whose ships, from whose decks of whose ships they were first seen. Lawrence Berggren, thanks so much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Really a pleasure.
Nice on Columbus Day to talk about the age of discovery and one of the great navigators who ever lived. Lawrence Berggren's book is Over the Edge of the World, the Magellan's Terrifying Circumnavigation of the Globe.